Good morning. Thank you for all for being here for this opening ceremony and talk of the Shila Ango. As I'm sure all of you know by now, we make the somewhat artificial distinction between the Prajna and Shila Angos in terms of the emphasis of practice. What it comes down to is that Prajna is about realization. Shila is about living out of that realization. There are two sides of the religious life. When we speak of living a life in the world as practitioners of Zen Buddhism, we are speaking of the religious life. Zen Buddhism is a religion, and when we commit to it by, among other things, taking the precepts, we adopt a religion. Now, a lot of people in Zen are reluctant to think of this practice as a religious practice. I suspect that many, perhaps most of us here, are here partly as a rebellion against what we think of as religion. I think that comes from the fact that our notions of religion are heavily colored by the upbringing most of us have had in a Judeo-Christian tradition of one sort or another. Buddhism is a recent transplant that in many ways seems to contradict our ideas of religious practice. It's been said that historically, when Christianity was introduced into non-Christian societies, much of the old so-called pagan religions became incorporated into the practices of the newly introduced religion. Something like that is happening as part of the evolution of American Zen Buddhism. Certainly when Roshi has explored the teachings of Jesus, they sound like they came out of the mouth of a Zen master. This morning, I'd like to look at another aspect of the Judeo-Christian tradition, the Old Testament, and specifically the book of Genesis. The Old Testament is sometimes looked upon as the antithesis of the teachings of Christ, but it, or at least parts of it, is so deeply ingrained in our culture that I doubt it can ever be totally expunged from our collective consciousness or replaced with something else. Nor does it need to be, but there does need to be some sort of integration. As someone who, like most of us here, grew up in a Christian household, went to Sunday school and church as a young child, and pretty much became either an agnostic or an atheist by the time I got into high school, I nonetheless continued to be haunted throughout most of my adult life by the myth of Genesis. I know this has been dealt with before here, but in thinking about what I was to say this morning, I have been inexorably drawn back to that myth. Perhaps the reason that this story of the creation and of the fall has had such power over so many is that it is inculcated into us at such an early age. As Roshi has pointed out, most of us don't even remember a time when we didn't know this story. It is that much a part of us. But is this the only reason? Is there something that this story has to teach us, in spite of the guilt trip that it seems to lay out, and the feeling that because of the fall, we are all somehow damaged goods? I think it does. Unfortunately, Genesis has become so distorted and misunderstood, especially in our time, that it has lost just about all of its real significance, even as myth, and has become a kind of weird cautionary tale of failure, of the horrible consequences of disobedience, and the vengeance of a God whose personality seems to resemble that of a desperate and fearful third world dictator. This is partly in the writing itself. It's quite possible the original writers did not quite get the picture, and certainly later interpretations distorted the matter even further. But in spite of all that, there is something very powerful here. And I'd like to take a look at Genesis in a different light this morning, in what I believe is its original intent, and try to see beyond the metaphor that we might find an important truth about our lives in this world. For Genesis is about coming forth. It is about the emergence of the universe from nothing at all. If there are any biblical scholars here, you may want to cover your ears, because this is probably going to be a heretical view. And in this, I'm enlisting the help of the remarkable Trappist monk and theologian, Brother Lewis, whom we know better by his birth name of Thomas Merton. It is his book, The New Man, that provides many of the ideas I'm going to present. As is the case with all myths, Genesis is written as a single event that happened long ago and far away. This notion of the single distant event is common to all myths. The accepted theory of the Big Bang, origin of the universe, is looked at in this same way, as something that happened a very long time ago. But to construe Genesis, creation, as a single distant mythic event is to give it, in a sense, too much significance. And at the same time, it robs us of intimacy with our own divinity, our own true nature, which encompasses everything, the creation, the fall, and the redemption. So God created the heaven and the earth. Well, who is God? Who's this God guy anyway? The God of Genesis is the undifferentiated one from which all springs forth, the primordial ground of being, the unknown and unknowable. It is what we work so hard at to uncover in ourselves on the mat in and out of Sesshin. It is beyond good and evil, light and dark, self and other. No self, no other, no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, or mind. And yet the very first sentence of Genesis reads, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." Creator and creation are no longer one. Separation, differentiation, coming forth. And it goes on from there to separate light from dark, heaven from earth, land from water, stars, mountains, rivers, oceans, animals, birds, and flowers. But why? How is it that this perfect, unsullied oneness at some point explodes into everything? This is a question that bedevils the astronomers and the high-energy physicists when they try to explain the Big Bang. How and why does this universe, in all its infinite variety, spring forth from a singularity? There is absolutely no scientific or rational reason for this to happen. The Buddha himself refused to deal with questions about time and place of ultimate origin because he felt that such cosmological questions were not useful in practice. So in Buddhism we have phrases like, from the endless beginning, since time immemorial, and so forth. Was creation a mistake? Is this the fall that is spoken of later in Genesis? In our practice, are we trying to return to oneness, emptiness, nirvana, and stay there? But again and again, God saw that it was good, and it was good. Not only good, but necessary, inevitable. To remain in a state of empty oneness is impossible. It would be like expecting all the molecules of air in this room to gather together in one corner and stay there, leaving the rest of the room in a vacuum. It won't happen. Singularity in and of itself is not complete. There is no knowing in oneness, no one to know and nothing to be known. There can be no knowing without differentiation. To be attached to things is illusion. To encounter the absolute is not yet enlightenment, writes Shito in Identity of Relative and Absolute. This coming forth, then, is a giving up of the tranquility, that peace that passeth all understanding. And it's a kind of sacrifice. Now, when we're starting out in practice, it no doubt seems that the real act of sacrifice is to sit down, cross our legs, and not move for a very long time. But after one practices for a while, and especially after an extended period of deep practice, like in a Sesshin, we are reluctant to leave that silent place where there is no coming or going, birth and death. Yet come forth we must, and for the same reason, that we are incomplete if we don't. So we sacrifice not only our attachment to form, but our attachment to emptiness, the ultimate peace and tranquility in order to come forth and know ourselves fully. The real question and the real challenge is how we come forth. Do we simply abandon the mat and go off into our lives willy-nilly? Or do we come forth in mindful awareness as religious practice, as a continuing process of moment-to-moment discovery? And here the book of Genesis has something to tell us, especially as regards that ultimate separation, Adam. Adam is the autonomous person, the human being separate from all creation. It should be noted here that at the beginning, Adam is neither male nor female. That differentiation hasn't happened yet. So please forgive me if I refer to Adam as him or he out of habit. Very hard to refer to a human being as it. Here's how Thomas Merton describes Adam. He writes, "Before the fall, Adam, the prince of creation, conversed familiarly with God in the sense that he was constantly meeting him in flashes of mystical intuition, either in the existential reality of his own spiritual depths or in the reality of objective creation. He walked the earth, therefore, as one who had no master under God. He could be conscious of his own autonomy under God as priest and king of all that God had made, knowing no rebellion in the simplicity and order of his own being. He was also obeyed by all creatures. His mind had a perfect knowledge of himself and of the world around him, and his will acted in perfect accordance with his vision of truth." I leave the references to God in here because, as Merton, as a theist and a Catholic monk, thought that way about what we would call oneness or the ground of being, but it in no way is to slight Merton's insight. Constantly meeting him in flashes of mystical intuition, either in the existential reality of his own spiritual depths, i.e. samadhi, or in the reality of objective creation, i.e. life in the world. Yet conscious of his own autonomy. When Dungshan saw his reflection in the river, he said, "Just avoid seeking from others or you will be far estranged from yourself. I now go on alone. I meet him everywhere. He is now just as I, but I now am not he. One must understand this way in order to unite with thusness. I meet him everywhere. He is now just as I, but I now am not he." Adam and Dungshan are both that ineffable fusion between oneness and differentiation, form and emptiness. Merton wrote that Adam walked the earth as one who had no master, priest and king of all, knowing no rebellion. His mind had perfect knowledge of himself and of the world around him, and his will acted in accordance with his vision of truth. The Buddha said, "I am chief without superior. I have conquered all. I know all, and in all conditions of life I am free from taint. I have left all, and through the destruction of ignorance and craving, I am free. Having myself supremely understood, whom should I indicate as my teacher?" I hope it's obvious by now. Adam, the first primordial human, is Buddha. Far from original sin, Adam is original divinity. But Adam is not yet finished. There is more. There is action. Even as the Buddha got up from under the Bodhi tree, Adam has to act in the world. What is Adam's task in this new state of being? "The Lord God," says Genesis, "took the man and placed him in the Garden of Eden to till it and to keep it." Adam is a caretaker. Adam takes care of the garden. There are many religions in which gardening plays a part as a form of practice. In the monasteries of medieval Europe, it was common for each monk to have a small garden which he tended as part of religious practice, and at the same time the raising of food. Merton comments, "In paradise, there was no opposition between action and contemplation. Consider Adam at work in the Garden of Eden. Even his activity had an essentially contemplative character." This is very different from our usual view of work in the world. We think in terms of goals, schedules, deadlines, tasks to be completed, stuff to get done. How often do we bring ourselves to a halt and contemplate our life of activity in the same way we contemplate our life on the mat. A shiatsu teacher of my acquaintance said that illness is just something to be contemplated. I was a bit shocked when I first heard that. I always thought, as most of us do, as illness is something to be fixed so we can get better and then can get on with our real lives. But if our life, as Genesis implies, is taking care of things the way Adam or a monastic tends a garden, then there is no conflict. If we're sick, we take care of being sick. And that can mean aspirin and bed rest or whatever is necessary, as well as contemplation. If we go to a job or raise children, we take care in the same way. Ultimately, there is no separation between our work on the mat and our work in the world. That we make this separation between prajna and shila is an artifice. It's a skillful means. We alternate between our sitting practice, in which we make contact with the absolute, and our mindfulness practice in the world of time and space and things. Back and forth we go, and ultimately, we hope, there's emerging an interpenetration. But with this work as contemplation, with this autonomy that we are given from the very beginning, comes responsibility. Merton again. If our work is to become contemplative, we must be free enough from things to be able to respect them instead of merely exploiting them. We must not only use them, but value their use and appreciate them justly for what they really are. We must understand what we are doing, and we must be able to measure and control the effects of our actions, not only on the things and persons immediately concerned, but also on others connected with them. We must work with a sense of responsibility towards living and growing things and towards those we live with. We must work with some consciousness of the value of human society, which is the beneficiary of our labors. In a word, our work ought to be a dialogue with reality. This, however, cannot be unless it is carried out with some measure of intelligence, with humility, and above all, with some awareness of the laws of cause and effect, and some attention to the remote consequences of our actions. Our work, what we do in the world of time and space, is a dialogue with reality, with our own Buddha nature. And this dialogue is to be carried out with humility and with our intelligence. It may seem strange that the two aspects of the human mind that most distinguish us from other animals, as far as we know, appear to be polar opposites. There is the scientific mind. This is the mind that inquires, observes, names, measures, weighs, puts data together and draws conclusions and makes predictions, tests results. The other part is the spiritual, contemplative part, the part that yearns for transcendence, that place of peace and tranquility where there is no coming or going, life or death. The fact is, these two aspects of mind evolve simultaneously and are, in fact, inseparable. The aspect of this mind that figures things out in the world of time and space is not to be despised, but to be used correctly as a tool, guided by the light of transcendent wisdom, that is to say, prajna. This is really how the scientific enterprise works, and the requirements of the scientific mind are exactly the same as what Merton describes as the requirements of the contemplative mind at work: intelligence, humility, and an awareness of the laws of cause and effect, and of the remote consequences of our actions. Without that personal integrity and upright behavior that comes out of spiritual practice, the scientific enterprise becomes impossible. In fact, the rise of scientific fraud in our time, I would contend, is a direct result of the loss of the sacred, the complete secularization of language and of life, the fear and distaste for religious living that is so prevalent in this time and culture. In our practice in the Shila Anga or any other time, we're not off the hook. We have the responsibility to use our mind in all ways. Yes, we judge. We look at consequences. It's not just a matter of going with the flow or feeling the spirit or any of the other New Age platitudes. Careful, methodical investigation of phenomena in time and space, and that includes careful and mindful living, is as much a part of the religious life as sitting zazen. A monk asked Joshu, all the dharmas, the myriad things, return to one. Where does the one return to? Joshu said, when I was in Seshu, I made a hempen shirt. It weighed 7 pounds. Well, there it is. The monk asked, what is beyond the one? If all things return to God, where does God go? And Joshu talks about a work project. Cutting the hemp stalks, soaking them, beating them to separate the fibers, weaving, measuring, stitching. A lot of thought, a lot of skill has to go into it. There is nothing un-Zen-like in grappling with intellectual problems in construction, science, math, any aspect of our lives, even philosophy. Dogen is revered as Japan's greatest philosopher, and his work is studied in universities all over the world. Many Zen masters were also formidable intellects. Toksan, Kyogen, our own Dharma grandfather Robert Aiken Roshi, to say nothing of the Buddha himself. But the point is that the intellect is a tool, and a tool cannot determine its own use. In case number 45 in the Mumon Kan, Hoan of Tozan said, Shaka, that's Shakyamuni, and Miroku, that's Maitreya, are servants of another. Tell me, who is this another? Yes, Shakyamuni Buddha and Maitreya Buddha. The words, the concepts, the composites of the five skandhas, the beings of time and space are only servants, even as our intellect. But who then is the master? Who is this another? Our discursive intelligence that deals in concepts like Buddha and enlightenment is a wonderful servant, but a lousy master. Worldly experience, knowledge, skills, and just plain street smarts, informed by prajna, the transcendent wisdom that comes out of practice on the mat, that's what adds up to compassion, right action. And this brings us to another aspect of our coming forth, and that is concepts. Language, words, speech. The Lord God formed every beast of the field and every fowl of the air and brought them unto Adam to see what he would call them. And whatsoever Adam called every living creature, that was the name thereof. And Merton notes that Adam named the animals before he had anyone to talk to. The Buddha said, all things are whole and complete, all beings are whole and complete, just as they are, endowed with wisdom and virtue. When he said that, there was no one else around at the time. Who was he talking to? Do words have a function other than communication? Merton believes that they do. And he writes, the primary function of the word is a contemplative rather than a communicative statement of what exists. Even if we never talk to anyone or think in terms of conversation with others, the mental word, dressed in its proper sound, stands in the depths of our intelligence to bear witness to reality. The word is a kind of seal upon our intellectual communion with this reality before it becomes a means of communication with others. We are often told that words and concepts separate us from reality, from our true nature. But just as a wall separates two rooms and at the same time connects them, so do words separate us from reality and at the same time they connect us. Words used properly are the communion, the sacred connection. They are the pointing finger. A sacred symbol, even as the Buddha on the altar or the Kanon figure we have just installed here. Dale Carnegie, the author of How to Win Friends and Influence People, said that there is nothing that a person likes to hear so much as the sound of his or her own name. Yes, I much prefer having somebody call me by my name as opposed to, hey, you in the brown robe. Makes me feel much better about myself. I teach anatomy to massage therapists, and many of them are reluctant to learn the nomenclature of anatomy, the names of muscles, bones, and all the other structures. They feel that it gets in the way of empathizing with the client. I think that if you know the names of muscles that you're working on, they're bound to feel better about themselves. And I think this is true of everything. Cups, saucers, chairs, tables. The naming of things can, in and of itself, constitute paying sacred homage to reality, the sacred communion. Knowing names is not a bad thing as long as we're not led down the primrose path of speculation and dreams. Robert Aiken Roshi uses the term grounded speech, words and speech that are grounded in direct experience. To be able to name things, this is a carpet, that's a window, this is a zafu, this is a lectern, is what he calls delusive wisdom. How could we function or communicate without it? Yes, language and words have a kind of arbitrariness about them, which can be even humorous, but it's an arbitrariness that we all share. It's our common bond. Without it, there is no teaching, no Buddhism. Case 24 in the Mumon Kan. A monk asked Fuketsu, both speech and silence transgressed, that is to say, they were concerned with relativity. How can we be free and non-transgressing? Fuketsu said, how fondly I remember Konan in March. The partridge chirps among the scented flowers. Fuketsu pays sacred homage to his experience through poetry. And it's not even his poem. It was written by somebody else. Poets are very good at this. It's not easy. I try now and then myself. But the truly great poems by Zen masters and others take us to a different place. The greatest poetry connects us to the sacred of everyday things. In the empty doorway, many petals are scattered. As they fall, they blend with the sound of the birds. Slowly, the bright spring sun appears in the window, and a thin line of smoke drifts from the incense burner. Ryokan. Did I believe I had a clear mind? It was like water of a river, flowing shallow over the ice. And now that the rising water has broken the ice, I see that what I thought was the light is part of the dark. Wendell Berry. This is not to say we all have to become great poets. Nevertheless, the writing of poetry, and I emphasize writing here, not just the reading, is a wonderful practice to help us make that communion, that connection. In the beginning was the Word. When words come forth in this way, they are Genesis, the beginning, the universe. The universe defines itself. Enlightenment defines itself. And as we create the universe very kindly creates us. And as is stated in Genesis, in its own image. How we view the world, how we speak of the world, is inevitably how the world views us, creates us. If we, in our thoughts, words, and deeds, create it as a place of suspicion and distrust, so we will be created as suspicious and distrustful. If we view it as violent and dangerous, so we will become violent and dangerous. If we view it with generosity and openness, so we will become. And this brings us to the third aspect of Genesis I want to address, and also the most problematic. This is the fall. Genesis reads, and they were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed. And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, of every tree of the garden thou mayest freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil thou shalt not eat of it, for in the day that thou eatest thereof thou shalt surely die. But of course, they go ahead and eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And the eyes of them both were opened, and they knew that they were naked. Now the crux here, and in subsequent verses, is nakedness. What is this condition of being naked as put forth in Genesis? It's not just running around the garden in the buff. One of the silliest pathologies of the so-called New Age of the 1960s and 70s was the notion that everybody should take off all their clothes, and this would somehow make you enlightened. Well, it doesn't work. Case 80 in the Hekigan Roku. A monk asked Joshu, "Does a newborn baby possess the six senses or not?" This is asking if the newborn baby has a discriminating mind. Joshu said, "It is like a ball bouncing on swift flowing water." The monk later asked Tosu, "What is the meaning of a ball bouncing on swift flowing water?" Tosu said, "Moment by moment, it flows on without stopping." Is there anything more naked in all ways than a newborn baby? Wide-eyed, open, utterly available to everything. Sights, sounds, smells, touch, no filters, no expectations, no judgments. Nothing is caught, nothing is clung to. Everything comes, everything goes, nothing stays. Can we live that way as an adult in a complex society? It's not about a return to some sort of second childhood. Our life experience, our academic studies, our job skills, our relationship skills, relationships themselves are not to be abandoned, but to be seen clearly and used freely, with no constraint on what or how things are supposed to be. When a child picks up a spoon, it can become anything. A shovel, a rocket ship, a drumstick, a sixth finger, an extension of his nose, an eyeglass. In some recent lay order renewal ceremonies, we had a couple of long discussions about various ways that our personal and marriage relationships have changed over the years. It was a wonderfully liberating experience. I think we all learned that there is no particular way that we have to be with each other. My marriage is whatever it is, with no reference to supposed to be or some ideal. We don't have to live our lives as they are supposed to be. We don't have to match somebody else's ideal. We don't have to pay attention to all those self-improvement magazines at the checkout stand. We have to strip ourselves naked of our preconceptions, judgments, ideas, biases, and presumptions. Each one of us has only to look at our own life as a child looks at a sunbeam. One of the preliminary koans that we work on here is a part of Secho's verse to case number 6 in the Hekigan Roku. "Slowly I cross a flowing brook and extinguish its sound. Freely I watch a flying bird and trace its path." It's a beautiful verse. There's no way you will ever demonstrate that koan if you are not spiritually naked. Adam and Eve partook of the tree of knowledge and thus knew good and evil. And the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked. What did they know? They knew that they were separate. Suddenly there was a separate self, a self opposed to other, to be protected, clothed, armored, a separate self that knows good, evil, man, woman, old, young, birth, and death. Merton writes, "Everybody knows that subjectively we see and feel as if we were at the center of things, since that is the way we are made. Pride, however, comes and elevates this subjective feeling into metaphysical absolute. The self must be treated as if, not merely in feeling, but in actual fact, that the whole universe revolved around it." Adam and Eve entered into the world of samsara as if it were something different from what they were already. They could not accept their own divinity. There was a rejection of half of their wholeness. So here at last we see what really constitutes the fall. The sense of I, not in itself a bad or evil thing. elevated to metaphysical truth. It's this attachment, this pride, and I might say demanding pride, that gets us into trouble, the trouble and suffering. The day that thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die. And die they did. They died to their own nature. The misery that Adam and Eve suffered was not a matter of some divine vengeance. It was just consequences. When we attach to notions of good and evil, right and wrong, and all the rest of it, we suffer. When we separate ourselves from our lives, yes, work becomes toil, child rearing a burden, and we lose track of our divinity and are caught up in and able to focus only on the endless round of birth, old age, sickness, and death. Is such a fall really possible? If Adam Eve is originally Buddha, can they possibly become not Buddha? What is this fall really, and why does Genesis make such a big deal of it? Thomas Merton writes of the fall as if it were an unnecessary event, as if it was something that could have somehow been avoided. With deepest respect, I disagree. The fall is not only possible, it is as necessary and inevitable as the creation. It is part of creation. How so? The Buddha said, I teach two things. I teach suffering and the extinction of suffering. How can you have one without the other? Without suffering, there's no practice. There can be no transcendence of suffering. Without the self, there can be no transcendence of the self. Without life and death, there can be no transcendence of life and death. In Christianity, of course, the redemption is embodied in Christ. As Merton puts it, without Christ, Adam has no function in Scripture. Without Jesus, Adam is merely the beginning of a story that wanders off unconclusively into nothing. Not only is Christ the term and fulfillment of creation, but he is also its source and beginning. He who told the Jews, I say to you that before Abraham came to be, I am, might just as well have said, before Adam came to be, I am. In other words, Christ, the Redeemer, predates and contains Adam. Redemption is already implied in Adam, even at the fall. Joshu said, even before the world was, this reality is. Now, Joshu was not referring to any reality that is separate from himself or from us. Dainin Katagiri Roshi writes, all sentient beings are allowed to live and are from the beginning forgiven for living their lives in this world. We have to live our lives in the complete realization that we are already forgiven. So what is this redemption for us? What is the forgiveness? It is the practice. The moment we sit down, cross our legs, and engage the practice, we realize that forgiveness, that redemption. Every moment of real mindfulness in our lives, we realize the forgiveness and the redemption. Dogen said, those who are just starting out in Buddhism may discriminate and think in secular terms. Their attempt to refrain from evil and to practice good with their bodies constitutes casting aside both body and mind. So this is not a matter of being an advanced student or a beginner, whether one has to take oneself in hand and practice self-consciously, or whether the practice practices itself. Practice at any stage is nonetheless practice. It is redemption. The real fall, the real tragedy, is not the temporary setbacks that we all experience. The real and disastrous fall is the complete and permanent abandonment of practice. And I'm not certain that that's even possible. As long as we are practicing, the fall is not that big a deal. Of course we fall. We mess up. We catch ourselves. We acknowledge that we messed up. We make amends as best we can and continue. Creation, fall, redemption happen continuously. It is a never-ending cyclic process, but it is not repetitive. Each time it is different, an ever-ascending spiral, or perhaps an ever-widening circle. If we clearly see that our words and our actions are the sacred connection to our true nature, to our Buddha nature, and more than that, they are our Buddha nature, right speech and right action occur naturally without effort. How could it be otherwise? How could we possibly violate the precepts? How could we possibly harm anything? How could we kill, steal, or abuse others? How could we lie, gossip, find fault, or sow discord? If we truly concern ourselves with practice, we need not concern ourselves with anything else. Joshu said, "When I was in Sesshu, I made a hempen shirt. It weighed 7 pounds. It's more than just a work project. Joshu pays sacred homage to his experience, to his life, even as does Fuketsu. Joshu's words and deeds are as much Joshu as his own skin and blood and bone. So it is with Adam, so it is with each of us. From the very beginning, there is no separation." Secho asks, "Do you know the meaning of the 7-pound shirt? Now I have thrown it away into Lake Seiko and sail before the wind. Who will share the coolness with me?" Who indeed? "Last night was cold. I wore heavy socks and a wool hat to bed. This morning the arthritis in my hand makes buttoning my shirt painful. The hiss and roar of the traffic enters my window along with sunrise. Together with all beings, we attain Buddhahood."